Hello and welcome to another episode of Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll. This is an episode that addresses a couple of, I would say, fundamentally important questions on how the infrastructure of our financial markets might look like in the future. We are going to focus today on the question, can permissionless blockchains be used as the underlying infrastructure for financial markets or financial services? And to that end, my fellow co-host Stefan Krasmann and I have invited the perfect guest, I would say, Professor Fabian Scheer from the University of Basel. Fabian is a professor for distributed ledger technology and fintech. He is a renowned expert in blockchain technology, decentralized finance, and related topics. And Fabian has been a guest before in this podcast in July 2022. We were just very surprised when we realized it's already almost 3 years ago when Fabian and I did an episode on decentralized finance, which is still worth listening. It was a primer on the topic. I will definitely put a link to this episode to the show notes. Fabian, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on again.
Thank you very much, Alex. And also thank you to you, Stefan. It's great to be back.
Stefan, maybe first question to you, because when we kind of organized this episode and I said, hey, Fabian is coming in April, you immediately said, hey, I need to join this episode.
Yeah, for all the people who know myself, I'm also a big proponent of considering public permissionless blockchains as the foundation for future financial services. I see a lot of value in that approach and discussing where the permissioned aspect should kick in and might kick in. And every time I listen to Fabian speaking or reading some of his articles, it feels close to my heart, actually, because it very much resonates with my line of thinking. I find a lot of value in his points. And actually, I was part of FUV Forum at Rüschlikon some weeks ago, where I enjoyed Fabian's speech, where he talked about a similar topic, and very good points. So was looking very forward to joining this discussion here.
Awesome. One reason for the discussion today is indeed a recent paper that Fabian, you have written for the European Commission. The paper is titled Enhancing Financial Services with Permissionless Blockchains. And my first question, what made you write this paper? So what made you decide to focus on the role of permissionless blockchains or ledgers for financial markets?
Basically, it's my research focus, right? I have been working at the intersection of economics, finance, computer science, with a particular focus on governance questions for quite some time. And one of the hypotheses that when all of this decentralized finance or more generally blockchain finance space emerged was when people talk about things like composability and atomicity, so basically connecting all of these different services and tokens with one another, then there are very strong network effects. Right? And these network effects essentially may lead to a future where you have a dominant base layer. And this, of course, gives rise to all kinds of governance questions. And then basically it was a big surprise. The European Commission, they had a tender on exactly that topic. They also approached me directly and I applied for it. And then I got the opportunity to write that paper, to write that report. And this brings me to another very important point that I want to highlight right now. When we discuss these topics, you have to make sure that we always understand that it's based on my research. In the end, it's my views. And we have to make sure that people don't see this as an official statement by the European Commission, right? So the usual disclaimer applies.
Sure, that's understood. Do you see a bit of since you're now in this space for many years, a bit of a momentum in favor of permissionless platforms? There was also this Coinbase paper that has been published shortly before Davos this year. I have to admit, I don't follow the academic literature as closely as you do. So is there a bit of a trend or the pendulum swinging more towards the permissionless platforms right now? Or how do you see that?
Absolutely. I don't think it's mainly coming from academia. I mean, on the academic side, I think there have been many people who are open to public permissionless for quite some time. What I see happening right now is that this is also a phenomenon that becomes increasingly more important in the private sector. So when you look, for example, towards commercial banks, who just if you go just 5 years back, all of their projects have been on permissioned blockchains, in-house experimentation, mostly Corda-based, and this has changed. So most of the experiments I'm aware of that are happening right now, your central banks, your commercial banks, are EVM based, and some of them are even on public Ethereum, which is something completely new.
Yeah, fully agree. I think empirically, when we look at which projects have been successful and have, let's say, gained traction over the last 5+ years, it's definitely clear winner permissionless blockchains. That being said, there are, of course, a couple of challenges that come with permissionless blockchains, in particular when using them as an infrastructure for financial markets. And we are going to dive deeper into this in a second. I just wanted to start maybe with a couple of important, let's say, questions or around definitions, because I just want to make sure we all talk about the same things here. And I think what we should define once is what exactly we mean, or you mean, Fabian, when you say permissionless versus permissioned blockchains.
Well, that's a really good question, right? And depending on who you ask, you might get different answers. To me, it means that there is no one with special privileges from the get-go. So there are no restrictions, basically, who can validate transactions. And again, it's another very confusing term, because the term validator is used in various kinds of ways. What I refer to with validation, I mean making sure that the transactions are executed in line with the blockchain's rules, right? That they can verify that nobody is cheating, that they can verify that the people who has initiated the transaction does indeed have the corresponding balance, that they can verify, for example, that a smart contract has been executed in line with what is written on that smart contract. And there should not be any special privileges that you, for example, say only an ex-ante defined subset of people can actually verify these steps. And then another question where things become a little more blurry is on the consensus side, right? It's when basically you're creating new blocks, so adding to the bookkeeping of the system, if you want to call it that way. And there, of course, you have lots of variations. And I would say it's pretty obvious that when you have something like proof of authority, where we say in advance, you, Alex, or you, Stefan, you are in charge and you are the only person who can contribute towards that bookkeeping, that is obviously not permissionless. But then, of course, things become more complicated once we start talking about things like proof of stake, as an example, right? When where I would argue it depends a lot on the implementation, and it depends a lot on the allocation of the assets and on the details, how this is implemented. So it's not that clear what permissionless actually means. And maybe just as a quick heads up, one of the key takeaways from the paper with the EU Commission was that you have to look really closely into the implementation, into the architecture.
I'm glad that you are very distinct with these points, because I think in many, many discussions, people think or suggest that it's a need-to-know basis for your counterparty when you're trading or so. I think it gets often mixed up what this permissioned versus permissionless actually means, that if anybody can validate or can contribute to the foundational layer of stuff, like setting up a mail server for the internet, that's for me a good comparison. Yeah, which banks really care for who transports their emails? I think they don't know everybody in that case too. It's not about money, but still, I find that a nice metaphor actually. Or on a higher level, that you actually need to know who you're trading against, which is absolutely not the question. I think there are valid reasons for this application layer permissioning, that there are use cases that need permissioning. I think both of us, or all three of us, won't say anything against that need. But the question we are just discussing here is, where do you actually want that permissioning? And there I'm very much on your side, Fabian, that I think it should be a bit higher up the stack. We can discuss where exactly, but that's also my opinion. Alex, what's your take on that?
No, I mean, I'm very thankful that both of you made that important distinction, because I always realize that this creates most of the confusion, because many people believe when they say permissioned that you actually want to permission the users, in the sense of I need to know everyone who's using the blockchain, which is not necessarily the case. And I want to emphasize that again, because let's make that distinction also throughout this episode. You can have a permissionless blockchain that has permissioned usage, maybe on a sidechain, maybe even with a particular token, right? That's all feasible and possible. And Fabian, I think this will be a very important point later in the discussion when we discuss about what is also technically possible in order to, let's say, adjust blockchains, the technology itself, to the regulatory needs that we might have, right? But permissionless, it's really the absolute base layer. And Fabian, I know that you're a big proponent of having, in particular, the base layer as a permissionless platform. So what makes you believe that that's much better to have this permissionless and to a certain extent decentralized versus having a infrastructure that's more closer to how the financial market infrastructure looks today?
I mean, today you have various different databases, right? And you have a really fragmented system. But when you think of a potential future where everything could be on one base layer, and then as I mentioned, the governance becomes really important, right? I don't want this foundational layer to be under the control of just one institution or just one entity, one company. This would not be ideal. Do you remember the Libra Diem proposal? The Facebook?
Yes, for sure. Yeah,
everyone was so worried about that stablecoin back then, right? And probably for good reason. But the thing that worried me even more than the stablecoin was the underlying infrastructure and the idea that they are essentially creating a platform for tokenization, for smart contract-based protocols. And if you think about that in terms of platform economics, what this means, it would probably be a really bad idea to give that in the hands of one company or of a very homogeneous consortium of people, right? And that basically allow them to act as gatekeepers, to allow them to extract rents, economic rents, would not be ideal. So to me, the base layer must be application agnostic, must be completely open, must not be under the control of just one entity. And it would not be ideal if somebody could unilaterally change the rules or exclude people. And then as you have mentioned, and also you, Stefan, clearly you need certain rules, you need certain restrictions, you need to adhere to certain regulation, but this should happen on the upper layers, right? You can do that directly on a token contract, for example. You can do that directly on an infrastructure smart contract, which gives you just much more flexibility. I mean, it would be so naive to believe that all of the tokens are subject to the same regulation. They are representing completely different distinct assets with a need for distinct regulation. So why should this regulation be enforced on the database itself when instead you can enforce it directly on the asset? It just doesn't make any sense. And also from an architectural point of view, whatever you do on the base layer must be seen as a minimum requirement, right? So for example, if you say only you, Stefan, you can join the base layer, unfortunately, Alex, you cannot, then you would be excluded from any applications on that base layer. In the end, probably a subset would be very beneficial if you could join them, right? So instead of just doing that on the base layer, once again, you could do it on the smart contract.
So one challenge today will be that we, of course, all three of us are very supportive of having permissionless base layers. I will nevertheless take the role now of a bit of a challenger, Fabian, and interested in how you will react to a couple of counter arguments. And one obvious one is, of course, I mean, a lot of the things today work relatively well, right? We have closed ecosystems today, not least something like Apple, for instance, one of the, I would say, most innovative customer-centric companies on earth. They are very closed. It's working extremely well. It's way easier to apply regulation in closed ecosystems. We have trusted organizations already today, like central banks. Why not giving that task over to them and say, hey, dear central bank, you just run a closed centralized ecosystem. It's super efficient. What speaks in favor of permissionless ecosystems?
I mean, first of all, it's debatable whether the system works well, but I think they're all, when you look at recent regulatory history, particularly with the Apple App Store and also some other platforms, there have been episodes where it's not that clear if it's working that well, and there has been regulation against it, particularly for competition policy reasons. And then also, we have to realize that we are living in a period of history where institutions have been working and to some extent still are working very well. Right? But this hasn't always been the case. I mean, there are so many episodes in human history where these institutions didn't exist in that way, where some dictators have risen to power and completely undermined these systems. And now just imagine if you're creating an infrastructure now, which is under the control of an institution that you can completely trust today, are we really sure that we can also completely trust them in 10 years? In 15 years, in 20 years? And what's the worst thing they can do if they are literally in control of anything that's digital, of all kinds of assets, monetary and otherwise, of financial market infrastructure, potentially identities? this monopolistic tendency, right, that you're centralizing anything on one database, essentially, at least on one base layer, gives rise to so many attack vectors once you undermine a governance system that is effectively controlling these platforms. Let me make one point really quickly, and then I stop. But you mentioned that we're all proponents of public permissionless. And in the sense that we are considering public permissionless as a potential system, that's absolutely right. But I think even in the European Commission paper, a substantial part of that paper was pointing out towards challenges, right? And was pointing out some things that are not yet working properly or are a severe risk. And I always say my worst nightmare right now would be to create such a system, a platform that is under the exclusive control of just one entity. My second worst nightmare is that something that is public and permissionless and open and neutral right now wins, but becomes that first thing later on because it gets completely undermined, which is also a severe risk.
Mm-hmm. I share this fear a bit when you see all of the geopolitical tensions that we see in the world. One of my biggest question marks is how can you set up that system that it stays credibly neutral when you see all these DeFi projects that now try to get close to the US and get the political favors. There are tendencies already at this upper layer applications, I would guess, that I wouldn't have imagined 2 years ago, maybe, but now winds are changing. So why shouldn't that happen for the base layer? Yeah? If certain economic incentives are in place that you actually lose the neutrality on the way, how do you think about these challenges?
I don't know. Honestly, I mean, it's a very good point. And I think we can talk about some specific attack vectors that I've also outlined in the paper later on. And it is a legitimate concern, right? Just it would be very naive to expect something just to magically remain in a decentralized status just because it started out that way. And whenever there are incentives, especially monetary incentives, then people will try to undermine it and you have to be very careful. And this was actually also part of the motivation for that paper, right? Basically, what the paper says in a nutshell is you should absolutely consider public permissionless as a base layer, because if you do not and you just give it to one company or one institution, then we have already lost before we even started the battle. But you should also not be naive about the potential challenges and things that do not work yet. And so that's why I point towards these challenges. Now, regarding the DeFi companies, and honestly, in many cases, I think what you're referring to are just blockchain companies and in many cases custodians or people who are operating completely centralized services that have something to do with blockchain, but not necessarily decentralized finance, right? Clearly, things like decentralized autonomous organizations, DAOs, also have their problems when you look into the voting process, but it's probably less of a result from the political process in the US and the move towards the US than just misaligned incentives and issues with the voting itself.
Before we go into the challenges, you have one really nice section in your paper. I think it's section 3 where you discuss like what exactly does or do public permissionless platforms bring compared to existing financial market infrastructure, because unfortunately, very many papers you read, in particular stuff that's produced in the private sector, less the academic research, always at a very high level speaks about things like fractionalization, programmability, and all these kinds of things. And my impression is that, and you also write that in your paper, that a lot of these things can already be achieved with existing financial market infrastructure. And you very nicely kind of distinguish between what exactly do public permissionless or permissionless blockchains bring to the table that's not achievable by existing financial market infrastructure. So I'll leave it to you whether you want to go into programmability, fractionalization, composability, atomicity, any of these topics. Would be interesting to get your view here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, because this was the most controversial section, I believe, right? Because when you look at some of these other papers in the public policy sector by institutions, then in most cases, they just mention the efficiency gains and things like fractionalization as the main advantages of blockchain, or as they often call it, DLT. But I completely disagree. I think, as you have pointed out, fractionalization, so essentially just creating smaller denominations on a database, has nothing to do with blockchain. I mean, there might be technical challenges that are preventing you from doing that today, for example, in a core banking system, simply because of the fact that most of these core banking systems are from the 70s. But it's nothing you get from blockchain, right? I mean, I can do that in an Excel spreadsheet, smaller denomination. So it doesn't make too much sense.
Maybe just to, Fabian, to give you one example on that point, since I'm working in the asset management industry, right? And one use case is always, well, you have these huge alternative asset funds, right? Where you have ticket sizes of 10 million, for instance. You need to tokenize these funds in order to decrease the ticket size. But as you said, I mean, it's just like we define in our IT systems, whether it's a 10 million ticket or a 5 euro ticket. It's not like a technical thing. And also by tokenizing, we don't solve this technical issue, right?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's in the end, it's another form of a data structure, right? When you tokenize something, it's a mapping in a smart contract on a blockchain, but there is nothing inherent to the blockchain itself or to this technology that suddenly makes fractionalization magically possible. We could also do that on any other database if you really want to. Then the execution side, right? So even smart contracts, I mean, yes, the Ethereum virtual machine, as an example, originated, of course, with Ethereum. But as witnessed by many of these centralized EVM-based projects, there is nothing preventing you from just executing a smart contract on your own machine. Right? I mean, we do that all the time in class, for example, at the University of Basel. We have a smart contract and DeFi class. And of course, when students are programming their own financial protocols, they're generally not deploying that to Ethereum mainnet. Instead, they're running it on their own machines. But this brings us to the thing that you get with a public blockchain, and that is new and that cannot be recreated with other systems. And this is the neutrality of the platform these things are running on. Right? When you think, for example, of tokens, maybe Bank A would not be too happy if infrastructure or a specific asset is running exclusively on a platform owned by Bank B. And Bank B, vice versa, would not be too happy if it's running on the infrastructure of Bank A. Once you start including things like atomic swaps, right? So basically the concept of including multiple transfers of assets in one transaction. Clearly, this is not something that can run on your computer, Alex, or in your computer, Stefan, or on mine. This is something that should be happening on a neutral environment, right? Something that cannot be changed unilaterally by anyone. So in the end, and I think this is also what I write in that section, if I recall correctly, blockchain is an innovation in governance. And the only thing you get that you don't get with other computer systems is that it's running in a neutral way. If you set it up correctly, and if you succeed in distributing the power well enough, and that by doing so, you get potentially a very rich set of applications, of protocols, of assets. And once you have that on the same platform, then you can use it in a composable and in an atomic way. And that might otherwise not be possible because you have a fragmented system.
And Fabian, I think the point of programmability is also often misunderstood. I have the following mental model, and I would be interested if you agree. I think bankers will say, okay, we can program our accounts, no problem at all. But the difference is that in this case, your users or a third party can actually program what happens to a token. And that is, and this combined with the composability that you can actually, so me as a user, I won't program most of the stuff. I will just use a third party and configure certain parameters, how the thing is programmed. But this can be someone else than the one who gives me the asset or gives me a wallet or an account. And I think this pluggability is the true virtue of these public permissionless things where anybody can actually again join. And I think this is also an emotional part of this permissioning thing. That's why I always get back to this question. So who is actually allowed to do so? Do you need to fill out a form with your government or with a financial regulator or so to do so? Or in the first place, at least for the first trial, this is an open innovation thing. And that's the programmability aspect that I think some people see and others not. Or how do you frame that?
I agree. I think it's the logical next step to open finance, right? I mean, the idea that you have all of these open interfaces, and what you get in addition to that is you have a platform that acts as the most foundational platform. And of course, you will have things like layer twos, you will have sidechains. Of course, you will have permissioning on top of it. There will always be some use cases that require permissioning, but you get the flexibility. And at least you have a base infrastructure foundation where anything is possible. I think what people are worrying about is that there can and will be smart contracts on there that are not in line with regulation. right? But I mean, that's, it's the exact same thing. If you go, I don't know, to your city of choice, you will find some shady business out there, right? But the question is, does this enter the regulated space? And even on a public permissionless blockchain, even if there is some shady business on there, it's not necessarily directly involved in a regulated process just because it's on the same process and the same blockchain. You might have a regulatory enclave, so a smart contract system on a public permissionless blockchain where you say, for example, only institutions can join that exchange, as one example, or only whitelisted people can interact with that token. This is all feasible. But you don't, the other way around is not feasible. If from the get-go you say we have a blockchain where only institution A, B, and C can join, then you don't even get the option of having other applications in there. You don't even have the chance to get innovation on there because you're restricting access from the get-go and you're creating something when there, where there is a lot of monopolistic power in the hands of very few people, and that's not ideal.
So another very interesting part of that section three that we were discussing before, and you mentioned it already once or twice, is that topic of atomicity, so atomic swaps. And I feel like this is closely related also to the topic of single versus multiple ledgers, and how is this going to play out, and what exactly is actually an atomic transaction. Because I feel like the whole community uses the word delivery versus payment a lot. But technically, this can be different things, right? And I liked your discussion about what actually is necessary to have a truly atomic transaction versus something that we might call delivery versus payment, but which is not actually an atomic transaction.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that the word atomic is used in various different ways, right? And I mean, one thing that is really fashionable, particularly in central banking circles, is so-called rigor solutions. So effectively, the idea that you have multiple different databases and that there is some signal from one database going to the other and then enforcing, quote-unquote, an action there, right? But this is not really atomic, and it's actually quite simple to understand. If you have multiple databases, if one of them shuts down, if one of them is not reachable, then you would still be in a situation where you only have an update on the other database, right? And what we are looking for with an atomic transfer is a situation where, let's say, Alice has a blue token and Bob has a red token, and they want to exchange these two tokens in a single transaction in an inseparable way so that they know that there is no principal transactional counterparty risk, that they know with certainty that either both of these tokens are exchanged or none of them. And you only ever get that through atomicity if both of these tokens are on the same platform. And if you have an execution engine framework that allows you to do so, right? So basically what happens is you have a smart contract. That smart contract gets the capability of either drawing tokens from these two accounts or has them already in custody. And then with one transaction against the smart contract, where you're calling a specific function, both of these tokens get exchanged, right? And that way, you know, it's either both or nothing. And what is important also to understand, it's not just DVP they can do with atomicity. I think you hinted towards that. It's DVP is just the very simplest example, delivery versus payment. There are so many examples of transactions that have dozens of steps within a single transaction. So for example, where, I don't know, somebody is calling a protocol that replicates some asset management function, right? And I don't know, they're sending a stablecoin there, and of course, then the allocation has to be changed. So in the same transaction, the asset management smart contract calls a decentralized exchange, swaps parts of these stablecoins into the allocation of that asset management contract. Then it might also be connected to a decentralized lending platform, where as part of the same transaction, once again, it's sending some of these tokens and gets in exchange and return some yield-generating form of that token as collateral. So you can have dozens of steps within the same transaction. This is super exciting because, once again, what is important, you cannot separate them, so it's either all or nothing.
I think this topic of atomicity, and even more so the topic of single ledger versus multiple ledger and transactions that you can do across ledgers, is also closely related to the topic of scalability. And that's one of the main challenges you address, of course, in your paper, as we see that in particular these permissionless blockchains have this challenge that they don't scale sufficiently in the sense that they can have a throughput of a number of transactions that they can serve as the base layer for all financial transactions, let's say that's ongoing. And Ethereum is, of course, a classic example. Now, what we see, and coming back to the single ledger versus multiple ledger, is we see approaches such as Solana, and I just use this as an example, don't want to discuss Solana, where the attempt is really to say, I take my base layer and I set it up in a way that it has a very high throughput, that I can do hundreds of thousands potentially of transactions, versus the approach of Ethereum, where I have a base layer and then maybe additional layers on top that enable scalability, which then potentially requires, of course, different blockchains to communicate with each other. And I would be very interested in your view on kind of which of these scalability approaches you believe is like the most promising one.
Maybe just one further remark towards the last topic really quickly, because I forgot to mention something. I've recently been involved in an IMF paper where we've discussed these various ledger types, right? These models, these platform types. So single ledger, common ledger, compatible ledger. And I think what we did not discuss so far, at least not in great detail, is that no matter where you start, be it with a compatible ledger model or a common ledger model, because of these network effects, because of composability and the atomicity, and because also of economic network effects, there is a really strong pressure to go towards the single ledger future. And this is, well, puts a lot of stress on the governance question, right? This is why I care so much about this topic, because I think there is a relatively high probability that we will end up in this future where we have a single base layer. Now, coming back to your scalability point, I have very strong opinions on that, Paul, because if you want to end up with something that is decentralized, if you want to end up with something where you can validate transactions with consumer-grade hardware, you are effectively bound by the resource limitations of that weakest node, right? But if you're creating something where you say, I have a gazillion transactions per second, and then, of course, you're basically placing a burden on all of the participants, saying you're only ever part of that network and you can only ever validate if you have computational resources that can support this validation. Here, we're not even talking about bandwidth, which is an entirely different problem. Effectively, what you would end up with in a world where you have ever-increasing blocks or ever-increasing computational limits within a given block, you would end up with something that would just be validated by a handful of people, right, and by a handful of data centers. That brings us to the question, what are alternative approaches? And basically, you can summarize most of the alternative approaches by saying you don't put all of the transactions directly on the blockchain. What you're doing is you're either just communicating the transactions bilaterally and have some commitment on the blockchain, like a collateral where you can be punished, or you sum them up on the base layer on the blockchain and all of the other information is on a so-called layer two. But all of these proposals, so be it linked state channels, optimistic rollups, DK rollups, whatever you have in mind, basically they come down to this, to similar principles. And the principle is that they use the base layer as a court. When things go right and when everyone agrees, you never have to go down, right? Or at least only with partial information. But if somebody tries to cheat you, you can go to the quote-unquote blockchain court and you can cryptographically enforce your right there. And you can prove that the other party was trying to cheat. And there are variations. So for example, what I've described is more accurate with optimistic rollups, because there you have the negative proofs. With CK rollups, zero knowledge rollups as an example, you're going the opposite way. So whenever you're summarizing the results of the transaction, you basically have to commit a proof based on zero knowledge proofs. And so it's a positive proof, but the principle is the same.
So I'm happy to hear that you clearly prefer, let's say, layer twos for scaling. I would like to combine this with a, let's say, related question, because layer twos can not only be used for scaling purposes, but also, for instance, anyone could basically build his or her own layer two for a specific use case, right? And this is also a way to permission to, let's say I have a certain sidechain, which is then permissioned for a particular use case. I mean, we see Coinbase, for instance, with Base, their layer two. And this is also why I was a bit surprised that you believe that there will be like one base layer in the end. Do you mean that, like, is it something like Ethereum and then we will have just very, very many layer twos, or will it be more like something centralized that serves as the single layer, base layer?
I don't know. I certainly hope it will be something as decentralized as possible. not going into specific blockchains, right? I mean, they all have their pros and cons, but I know with certainty is that I would be extremely worried if it would be, as we've established in the beginning, something that's under the control of just one entity, right? So I maybe also it's just some qualifying remarks. And when I say one base layer, then I'm not ruling out sidechains, right? And certainly I'm not ruling out layer twos. Also, I'm not ruling out that there might be some fringe chains for specific applications, right? But what I'm saying is there are very strong network effects that most of the economic activity within one given economic area is on one database. And so, of course, when there are political tensions in various economic areas, then you would have multiple base layers, right? That's also something but at least for a given economic context, there are all these network effects towards one base layer.
Now that we are in the challenges part, I would like to tackle the privacy thing, because I think this is not only a problem for public permissionless chains. It usually is also an interesting challenge for permission chains, even if some people deny that it would be. But if they are EVM chains, they have similar problems, just on a smaller scale. And now even talking about layer one or layer two, where do you think this privacy problem might be solved over time? Is it the layer, a specialized layer two that holds back certain information? Will critical data kept off chain? Or how do we, I think this is one of the very foundational problems that we obviously haven't solved so far.
Well, absolutely. I agree. I think it's a topic that's dear to my heart. I think it's super important. It's underappreciated. And I'm also glad that you're mentioning that this is a problem that also exists on permission systems, because sometimes when you talk to regulators, you get the impression that the issue of privacy can be solved simply by trusting someone, right? If you just have one entity and they see everything and no one else sees the information, as long as we can trust them, everything is fine. This is clearly not the case. I mean, there have been so many episodes where even large and reputable companies have been hacked for user information. This is clearly very risky, right, for many different reasons. So in maybe just to frame the problem quickly on public permissionless, there is this misconception that public permissionless is great for money laundering and for illicit activity, and that you can hide anything behind these pseudonyms. And this is simply not true. Now, clearly, there are cases of money laundering on public permissionless. I'm not saying this never happens. All I'm saying is we have to be aware that we are on a system where anything you do, any transaction, all of your balances, anything you have ever done, and anything you will do when somebody has your address is publicly observable. And this does not really seem like an ideal system for criminal activity. Also, the pseudonym is a really weak protection, because a good analogy would be saying your bank account number is also a pseudonym. So why don't you share your balances and all of your transactions with the general public? You could do that, right? You're hidden behind your bank account number. And the answer clearly is because when somebody has sent you money or when they're interacting with you, they can map this bank account number to your name, and it's not really anonymous, it's pseudonymous. Now, in terms of solutions, once we have established that there clearly is a need for some privacy and some protocols, in terms of solutions, there are various approaches. And this is what makes me optimistic. It's not just one single solution or one approach that is being explored. It's actually dozens of different solutions, right? And on all ends of the spectrum, from something that makes things completely anonymous to also proposals that try to balance regulatory compliance and some privacy. So I give you one example, because I was involved in that research. It's called Privacy Pools. It's something I have published together with Vitalik, Armin, Jacob, and Matthias. And the idea there, the basic idea is it's an extension of a Tornado Cache, where you can establish some more nuanced proofs. So where you, for example, can show that when one of the deposits in that privacy enhancing protocol originated from a hack, that they can prove that your withdrawal, the thing you're taking out of that privacy enhancing protocol, is not related to that one questionable deposit. You don't have to prove anything else, right? But you can show mathematically, cryptographically, that this was not you. Or let's go with another example. Let's say five of the deposits with their previous history have been verified by a bank, right? And KYC, AML, anything that might be required has been done successfully. Now, when you're withdrawing, instead of having to show exactly which of these deposits relate to your withdrawal, it might potentially be sufficient in some jurisdictions that you can prove that your withdrawal is one of these five deposits without telling them which one. And so you have a lot of flexibility. Then other approaches, for example, include fully homomorphic encryption, which is just a complicated word for effectively saying you're doing some math on encrypted values. And in the terms of relation to tokens, what you do is you're hiding the balances on the blockchain, the specific balances of who owns what. But the smart contract can still enforce that nobody is spending more than they're actually owning, which would be a really big improvement for some applications, right? So again, I think we don't have to go into any more examples, but what is important to understand is there are dozens of these proposals, and it's very promising. And I think it's important that we step away from this idea that privacy is something bad and that only criminals want privacy, because we have to be aware once again that public permissionless blockchains, as they exist right now, are the only system I am aware of where you ask to share everything you, or anything you've ever done, right? Any transaction, any balances. It just clearly is not good.
So I appreciate that there are many proposals for, and you list other challenges and other potential solutions in your paper. We won't have time to go through all of them today, unfortunately. I wanted to ask a related question coming back to, I appreciate that these are proposals for solutions today. Where do we stand when it comes to actually today moving a considerable part of our financial markets onto these public permissionless blockchains? Are these blockchains already, let's say, mature enough to kind of serve as an infrastructure for financial markets? What are the main things? And if not, yeah, what are the main things that you believe need to happen until we reach that point?
Right now, I think it would be incredibly risky, right? And we have to get a better understanding. All I'm basically calling for is it should be considered. We should look into it. But this does not mean, clearly, it does not mean switching the entire financial market infrastructure to a completely new infrastructure that is, in many cases, poorly understood. And my main concerns effectively relate to governance and transaction sequencing. Now, you mentioned we don't have time to go into all of them, so maybe we leave out transaction sequencing, and I urge anyone who is interested in that topic to read the paper. But governance, I think, is super important to come back to, right? And one thing that troubles me in particular is something we refer to as reverse dependencies. This is from a paper that we've recently written together, Cesare Fracassi and Watson Coya from the University of Texas at Austin. And basically what it means is if you have a dominant application or a dominant token on a public permissionless blockchain. So think a stablecoin, for example, that is used in all kinds of transactions, that is used as collateral on the infrastructure, then the issuer of that token may have some implicit veto rights on the future development of that blockchain. So you have the situation where, for example, part of the community thinks, well, we should implement that feature, right? And another part of the community thinks, no, we should not implement that feature. Then how things usually work with blockchains is they have a discussion. There is some formation of a rough consensus with either there is a compromise or in the end they go separate ways with a fork. If you have a dominant application and the stablecoin issuer, for example, says, well, you can do whatever you want, but we're only going to support option B, then all of the protocols that are using that as collateral, that stablecoin, and anyone that is interacting with the stablecoin don't even have the option. They also have to go with option B. There's absolutely no way they can go with A because it would be worthless, the collateral on the other chain. And that worries me a lot because it completely undermines a lot of the governance. It basically creates these reverse dependencies. And clearly, there's a lot of research required to understand who could potentially have an influence over these systems and how can we ensure that they actually remain neutral over time.
I would have one last question, and it's related to governance. And Stefan, maybe you can think of your last question if you still have one. And that's something that concerns me a lot working in the financial industry, let's say, and of course, pushing that topic from there, is this topic that the validator set is open on permissionless blockchains. So theoretically, it could be that a certain transactions that you do is validated by a party you do not want to sponsor. And usually the example that's used is, let's say it's a North Korean hacker, right, or a North Korean terrorist or whatever, who validates your transaction, and you actually, let's say, as a German regulated bank, pay transaction fees to that North Korean hacker, which is, of course, an absolute no-go. And I have really trouble thinking of how to solve that other than try to make that validator set as big as possible and just hope that it's not going to be that North Korean guy. And I would be really interested in how you look at this problem.
Well, it is an issue, right? I mean, there's clearly, if the requirement is that absolutely, there's absolutely zero tolerance, and to my understanding, even though I don't have a legal background, that is the requirement right now. Then it is an issue because you will pay potentially some transaction fees to entities that may be on the sanction list, right? There is one way around this, but it's something I'm extremely worried about. I discovered that as a potential solution for the very problem you're describing, but I think the solution itself may create more problems than it actually solves. And what I'm referring to is there is a way to get the address of the validator, or more recently, the block builder, in the execution context, which means when the transaction is executed, you can get the information of who is either building or validating the current block, and work with that address as part of a smart contract. One option, and again, I'm not supporting this, I think it's super risky, and I will come back to this. One option is that you look at this address, and then, for example, as part of a transfer function in your token contract, you check this address with a token-specific custom whitelist. And you say, by the way, my token can only be successfully transferred not only if the recipient and the sender is on a whitelist, but also if it's being validated or built by somebody who is on my custom whitelist. Right? And I want to be very precise again, this is not something that would be on a protocol level. This would be a custom whitelist for validators / block builders in the smart contract and would be validated there. Now, clearly, with that solution, even though there are some drawbacks, with if you set the TIP to zero, if you're interested, look into TIP and EIP 1559, and considering that the base fee is being burned, you would not pay any transaction fees to anyone who is not on that whitelist. So that would solve this issue. But it would also be a very powerful potential attack vector to undermine decentralization. Particularly if we go back to the previous example and we consider the existence of a, let's say, a very dominant stablecoin once again, and then imagine a situation where the issuer of that stablecoin would implement something on the token contract, then true composability, and because of the fact that this stablecoin is being used in a substantial part of all transactions, because of composability, this could effectively be an attack vector on the entire validator / block builder set and undermine the decentralization of the system. So even though it's started as a potential solution for the very problem you just described, I think it's net negative, and it's actually something I'm worrying about a lot, and I think can have some really, really bad consequences for the governance of public permission systems.
Yeah, very interesting. Complex problems usually don't have a very simple answer. But maybe one final question from my side. So you created this very interesting paper for the European Commission. I was wondering, what was their reaction to this? Did you have the opportunity to talk some of your findings through with them? What do they think they will learn from that? Just as a final one.
Yeah, I probably cannot speak for the European Commission, right? It would not be fair. What I can say is just yesterday we had a webinar that they have hosted, and there the feedback was very positive. But this is not just people from the European Commission. To my understanding, it's public. Lots of attendees. I think it was 250 people in the webinar. And great questions, and also the discussion afterwards, I think, was very positive. So the question is, would they have told me if they didn't receive it well, right? And it always, whenever you give a talk somewhere, it's well received. So I said, I don't know, but at least I had the impression that they've liked it.
Yeah, but I participated in that webinar. It was really a nice one. And I think 250 viewers is really good for a live webinar. We will do more than 250 listeners usually here in that podcast. And we, Stefan, I hope I also speak for you. We appreciated it a lot, Fabian, that you that you were our guest today. So thanks a lot for taking some time and walking us through your paper. I will definitely put the link into the show notes. So for everyone who is interested, just look into the show notes. Also, Stefan, thanks a lot for co-hosting this episode. Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Make sure to like and subscribe. And of course, tune in again next time. Hopefully, Fabian, this was not the last time in this episode, and maybe we can make it happen earlier than in 3 years. I would definitely look forward to that.
That's good. Thank you very much, Alex and Stefan, and I hope to be back.
Thank you, Fabian.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.